And we're back, Stripe Show podcast on a Monday. Thank you for joining us, for those out there, as we enter live on Twitter, YouTube, and Facebook. We'll get this up, of course, full video format on YouTube and then also on all the audio platforms. Thank you for being here. Hopefully you had a great weekend. Lots of golf to discuss, and a guy that is trying to take a little time off because CBS doesn't, you know, pick things up here for another couple weeks. And I know he's got a long stretch ahead of him. So I was like, hey, you mind, like, you know, giving me 30 minutes? And I'm very grateful for it. Frank Nobilo, how you doing, sir?
Great. Thanks, Travis. Yeah, no, I've been trying to duck you for a while, but I had no excuse this time. I wasn't working. You knew I wasn't working, so I couldn't say no.
Yeah, that's right. I was like, you know, I know he's not out there because CBS is not working. NBC has the slate. But your first event back, let's start there, is a little tournament called the Masters. And
yeah, just a little one.
Yeah, and that's always, you know, perhaps the biggest event of the year. But it's going to be even bigger this year, Frank. Let's admit, with the PGA Tour, LIV Golf, that, you know, that room on for the winners and their dinners party. My goodness, would I love to be a fly on the wall and what's going to happen there? You've got to be excited for the Masters here in a couple weeks.
No, there's no doubt about it, Travis. I'm lucky to be part of it because when you think about it, the viewer loves conflict. Now, the ones involved in it, whether it's, you know, the head of the PGA Tour, head of LIV, or even the producers, they mightn't like it, but the viewer does. And they've missed some of these players. I have too. To be honest, the player that I've missed the most from that's gone to LIV is Cameron Smith. I just thought he was going to be a world beater. He fitted in so well with the Spieths, the Justin Thomases of the world. And I really thought he was going to help usher us into the next decade. And especially the way in which he played last year in the Players' Championship and the Open Championship. I mean, that final nine holes against Rory, I mean, that was just clutch. So that's what I miss. And hopefully we'll get a bit of that at Augusta. You know, we have the history because, you know, the event, it's always so easily recognizable for the viewer. They know the holes. That's actually why it's a hard broadcast to do, because normally you want to go, well, here's 12, it's a short par 3. And the viewer goes, I know it is. I've seen it. I know the holes. So you actually try and do, you know, less is more, very much so at Augusta. But this year, it will be special.
Yeah, I miss Cam. You know, I miss Dustin Johnson. You know, I miss the villains, you know, Bryson and the role that he played, Brooks Koepka. It's interesting, though, you know, those guys over at LIV, we're going to talk more about LIV here in a minute and the tournament that was in Tucson. But, you know, none of them are really playing that well. I mean, DJ put a few things together there in Tucson, but Cam's kind of struggled really for the better part of, it feels like, 5 or 6 months. DJ hasn't been himself, and Bryson is finishing near the bottom. I'm just curious, all this money that's in the pocket already, it just feels like human nature that you would lose your edge, your competitive spirit just a little bit. Now, for all intents and purposes, they show up at Augusta. I would not be surprised if one of those four did win. But it does feel like the big names in LIV are struggling a little bit.
Part of that's because of timing. This is still very early in the season for them.
Yeah.
Bryson, it's a little different. I remember watching, was Ian Baker Finch and I went out in the practice round. And we saw Bryson very early on in the practice round. And I've known him over the last 4 or 5 years, got to know him. I liked a lot of the things he was trying to do. I think he's made us look at the game very, very differently. That's another reason to the golf ball debate, which hopefully we'll talk about a little later. But, you know, Bryson was one, whether you agreed with him or not, he made you think. But then sadly, I asked him about his wrist. And he had the same doctor, Dr. Tom Graham, who's actually did my wrist and my thumb. And he showed me a picture of the Hamlet bone, and it's just almost shaved down to nothing. So I think, sadly for Bryson, I mean, that wrist is just taking a hammer with a lot of the things he's trying to do. So for him, I think it's injury avoidance. Can't quite play the way he would like to. But for you know, DJ, Brooks, they know that they're going to be playing the major championships this year. So I actually think for the first time, they're trying to have more of a normal schedule where you slowly build up to, for them, Masters, which is in, you know, 3 weeks' time. Then the US Open, then the Open Championship, or sorry, PGA Championship in the middle there as well. So I think they've got a slightly different schedule, and consequently, they're not going to be at the top of their form right now.
Yeah, they're off this week, and then they go to Orlando. They'll play a crooked stick there at Orange County, and then of course Augusta. Now to the PGA Tour, last week, Valspar at Copperhead. This week they do the match play, the last year of the match play in Austin. And then it's the Valero Texas Open, and then they all meet at Augusta. Let's talk about Valspar on Sunday. It was quite the finish. Anytime you have Jordan Spieth playing in the final group and the Jordan Spieth experience, it's just must-watch TV. I find myself, Frank, I'm at a point where when Jordan misses the green, I'm running in there to make sure that I get to watch him hit a bunker shot. I've never seen anything like it. I'm just curious, as a starting point here before we get to Taylor Moore, does Jordan, and you, of course, you've covered him for years, but when you played, you've got 14 wins worldwide. You've played with the best players of your era. Does he remind you of anybody, or is he just, does he just stand alone in itself from your era to what we see now?
It's a great question. I think if you try and steal bits and you go Ballesteros, for example, because of the short game, the ability to be dangerous from a bad position, that's probably the only analogy, but you know, the swings are so radically different. Mm-hmm. You know, Ballesteros was a good friend of mine, and you know, his bunker play was different as well. Sivi was a phenomenal bunker player, but they both have hearts of lions. So, you know, there's a great Ryder Cup match off the top of my head between Sivi, he had no game, and Tom Lehman. And I think Sivi was one up through the first nine holes. He did get beat. But Lehman's like just playing it down the middle on the green. He can't believe that Sevi's holing chips, bunker shots, and he's actually one up through the turn. And eventually it ran out. But there's a touch of that in Jordan. But I really do think he's an original, which is one of the reasons why he's a good watch. Because Sevi didn't talk the way he did in amongst the ropes. So with Growler and Jordan, I mean, basically we don't have to do our job, which is great. And they, you know, some people don't like it that he talks too much, but he's incredibly candid, and he wears his heart on his sleeve, so it's very transparent.
His game is made for TV. You said that before we came on air, and it really is. That's the best way to describe it. You know, he can get it going and fill it up, of course, but what really makes Jordan is not only the back and forth, and he's always talking to his golf ball, and some people like that, and sometimes that gets under their skin. I'm sure as a player playing with him, that could probably get up under your skin a little bit, especially when he's talking to it, and it's going to go out of bounds, and it hits the tree, and it comes back in, and then he makes eagle. But it's just the unexpected. I mean, that's – you just don't know. I mean, it's like, you know, he steps up to a par three where the closest shot – has been 25 feet all day, and he knocks it into 8 feet. You know, now he's gonna step up there and he's gonna make that putt, and he doesn't even touch the hole. It's just like this constant. You just don't know what the hell is gonna happen. You can't count him out, and then he hits the big shot, and now he's gonna push ahead, and he three putts. And it's just like, my God, this is exhausting. You know, watching this.
It's exhausting for him.
It's exhausting for him, Michael Grell. I can only imagine. Michael Griller. I mean, this guy's taking it all in. I mean, he's got to listen to it, and he's got to go through the ups and downs of all this unexpected golf.
Yeah, if you watch very, very closely, though, there's a slight change from Jordan of like 2014 and 2015. And as a matter of fact, at Genesis, I tried to show Griller on the putting green. I think it was after the Saturday round. I just took my camera and my phone, and I just sort of videoed the back of his head when he's putting. So if you go back to Spieth in 2015, he did one or two things. He looked at the hole, or he kept his head incredibly still. And I know we say, you know, keep his head still, and we sort of overdo it a little bit. But with Spieth, if you look at footage when he was like unbeatable from 20 feet, his head was ramrod still. And then now what happens is he's not sure if he wants to look at the hole. He did do that in Valspar on the short ones. But when he gets to about 10 or 15 feet, as the putter goes back, the first move, and you can see it with the logo on the top of his head, the eyes go as he releases the putter forward. And you'll see it, and it goes to different amounts, so different degrees on the stroke. And consequently, in my opinion, that's been the biggest problem with his putting. And that's why you'll see him miss from 8 or 9 feet when he used to be clutch in a big moment. So I think some of it's technical. And the reason why is because, as you know, you're the coach out of the two of us here. I mean, he spent so much of the last two or three seasons on the long game.
Yep. Yeah, there's no question. And I've been talking about Jordan Spieth every single week as part of the instruction aspect of this podcast, and have been dialed in on, you know, the changes. Obviously, he went after some distance, and then from there, the shaft started getting more laid off. And, you know, when you start toggling with that laid off club shaft, and it's a sensitive line, you know, you think it's across the line from a feel perspective, and then you look at it and it's not. And so it's the ultimate feel versus real. And it's difficult because when it toggles that line and how that affects the shaft and transition, can be problematic, but he has worked through. I give him a lot of credit. I give him a ton of credit working through getting the club in a better spot. It still does look a little laid off from time to time, but it does feel like he's kind of passed a lot of the heavy lifting and now starting to play at least a little bit more instinctive golf. Now, the winner of the tournament was Taylor Moore. I don't feel like a lot of people out there really know the Taylor Moore story. 29 years of age, went to University of Arkansas. It was quite the day for Arkansas, who beat Kansas, the number one seed in the NCAA tournament, to go to the Sweet 16. So now one of their own gets into the winner's circle for the very first time. I'll start with you, Frank. Just kind of share with my audience a little bit about Taylor Moore, who he is as the professional.
Well, he's a great athlete. He could have gone pro as a baseball player. I think that's the first thing you should tell people. And the reason why, it puts him in the athletic category, right? Like a Tony Finau. It means you're good. Hand-eye coordination. Obviously, hitters, baseball players, they've got power. Then when you look at his swing, it's a little different because he's found a way, I guess, through his own engineering along with Josh Gregory. Yep. He tries to keep the club face as square as possible through the hitting area. So his follow-through is a little different from probably most of the other people you see on the range. But I started watching him last year, obviously, on the CBS run. And it was towards the end of last year. But you've got to remember, last year we had Thagala played great. Davis Riley was playing great. And, of course, the best of the rookies was Cameron Young. And he was contending in major championships. So in amongst the wash, we really sort of lost the Taylor Moore story. But if my memory serves me correct, Detroit is really where I first noticed him. I think he finished sixth, was definitely a top 10. And then the following week was Greensboro, where he finished fifth.
Yep.
So the other last 2 weeks of the year, that gets him in the playoff. And he didn't actually miss the tour championship by that much. But like I said, the other three rookies, and actually there was a couple more, it was such a great rookie class that we were talking about. So sadly, you got caught in the wash. But if you look at his stats this year, they're still really solid. And he's made a lot of cuts, plays a lot of weekends. And the standard, as we all know, is extremely good out there, but it hasn't bothered him. And I think that's the main thing. You know, you look for the sophomore slump. Well, he got the sophomore win.
Yeah, you mentioned Josh Gregory. He's been under Josh's camp for about 3 or 4 years. I've talked to Josh about Taylor. And, I think just kind of a steady improvement since turning pro. Had the one win in the Corn Ferry Tour, was part of that rookie class, as you mentioned. And he left, Josh kind of, he said a couple things that kind of hit me. One is, like a lot of players do when they're with a coach, they'll see something and then they're like, hey, I want to go do that. And I want to go try that. And so at one point, Taylor did go seek a second opinion and it didn't go well. And he struggled much of, I think it was last spring. And then he kind of got back with Josh. They got back on the blueprint, and some things started to really move in the right direction again. You look at him at the first of the year, he was 11th at Farmers, 15th at AT&T, 14th at Waste Management. Something happened at Waste Management this year where he got paired with Justin Thomas. And Justin had a lot of nice things to say to Taylor about his game. The directors keep doing what you're doing. But one of the things, and this was Josh telling me the story, that stuck with Taylor was just how Justin Thomas hit his wedges. And Justin has that bigger arm swing, and he really just kind of controls things with pacing his arms, kind of this rate of turn. Like it never looks like he's taking it back halfway or three quarters. Like it's just kind of this long, and he can hit it different distances and control. And Taylor just got enamored with that and wanted to go down that path and really try to make his wedge game that way. And he started to struggle a little bit with that. It started leaking into his full swing. And Gregory stepped in about the players this year and said, look, you need to get back to kind of what you were doing. Again, we're on the right track. Just stay with it. And for Taylor, he controls his wedges with, kind of the length of the arm swing and then covering it like a lot of guys do. There's different, there's different ways to do it. So anyway, he got back to the blueprint, had some nice rounds at the players, got to the Valspar. Everything started clicking, and he gets into the winner's circle. Frank, it's always interesting to me, these players, even when they're on the right track, even when the success is there, they see something one of the top players do that they like, JT's wedge game, and they gravitate to it. And they feel like, well, now I'm going to do it. And it's not exactly what they need.
I think it's a great point, Travis. And I don't know of a single athlete that doesn't go through that.
Okay.
And I think the reason why, and I know with my own situation, it was the same. You're easily impressed. You see someone that's at the top of the game, former world number one. And you're right about his wedges, because he's what I call a rhythm-based wedge player,
right.
Justin Thomas, right? Mm-hmm. So it's just a nice, smooth swing, still hits them extremely shallow, whereas a lot of players nowadays, they use the clock system. In other words, when my left arm is at 7:30, the ball goes a certain distance with my lob wedge, my 56, my 50, so there's my gaps there. Then when I put it to 9 o'clock, these are the distances. Then when I get it to 10:30, the other distances. So that's the way a lot of other people implement it. But, you know, when you, I just mentioned Ballesteros before, when you first play with him, you go, man, the way in which he sets his wrists, maybe that's the reason why he can hit these amazing bunker shots. So you invariably go to the practice bunker and you try that. And then sometimes you go down the rabbit hole and it's a problem. But normally it's because there is doubt. Deep down, you're a rookie or you're young. So you do. You doubt your own ability. Am I really good enough to go the long distance? So that's the internal thing. But then you look externally. In other words, if I change my putting style, change my driver, whatever the case. So if I grab something out there, that's going to make me a better player. And then invariably, if you've got someone to trust like he has in Josh, you go back to the internal and you go, actually, I'm good enough. If I just give myself time, the way I do it is still the best way for me. But you have to figure that out yourself, because otherwise it's not the best way for you. Mm.
That's well said. And that's really what Josh really reiterated to me, was that he kind of let him go down the rabbit hole. He's like, sometimes you got to let him go. And he says now he's come to that conclusion himself and realized that, wait a minute. And then, of course, Josh stepped in and said, look, you ready? Let's get back to the blueprint. You know, here we go again. And so it could be incredibly frustrating for a player or for a coach like Josh when your player is always, you know, but like you said, most players, they do that. They gravitate. It's human nature. Mm. When you're watching one of the best wedge players and one of the best players in the game in JT, and he's complimenting you. And now you're like, okay, I can just do that a little bit more. Gosh, how good can I get? And so heading into Valspar, he felt like, okay, they're back on the blueprint. And then he challenged Taylor. He said, look, he says, you're ready, man. Like, the game is there. You've become a better putter. Your ball striking's moving in the right direction. Your short game is getting, you don't really have a weakness anymore. And so he kind of challenged him now to go out there and play aggressively in a way that mentally you're ready to win. You know, you're ready to go out there and win. Don't be passive. Don't play not to win, right? And so he kind of challenged him that, and he did that. He felt like the shot on 13, the shot on 15, he stepped up and hit the shot. The putt on 16 was a long one, but he really thought the bunker play on 17, that was a tough shot, and he almost
it was a great up and down.
It was a great up and down. So there was like two or three moments down the stretch where he could see a difference in Taylor, and he was going to win the golf tournament. You know, he looked different to his coach's eye. So I thought that was a pretty cool story, you know, just coming right from the horse's mouth in this coach player dialogue, and how a player can get off the blueprint, get back on it, but then challenge him in a way that it's time to win. You can do this. And off he did. And he went and got himself his first W.
Yeah, Josh has been around enough good players now to realize the letting go process.
Yeah.
And as I referenced before, the doubt word. And I think once that doubt word, and you're going to have doubt through your whole career. There's no doubt about that. But when that's replaced every now and again with trust, that's when the athlete becomes dangerous.
Mm.
And collectively, they've done a great job. The coach allowing the player to grow, and then the player in the end not going elsewhere, but realizing that the pair of eyes he has looking over him are the right ones for him. So that's a success.
It is. One of the things I've heard from coaches too, it's that they'll say in coaching a player like a Taylor Moore, who's not a superstar, right? Hasn't won yet. For them to take on shots down the stretch, like he did on 13 and 15, is harder to do for them than say a player like a Jordan Spieth or Rory McIlroy, who have more money in the bank or more proven. It's harder for them to take on those shots. But at some point, you've got to step up and take on the shot if you want to win and you want to maybe potentially be in that same conversation as the next tier of players. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, you just detailed the reasons why. Money, championships. If you're going down the stretch with a player that has a resume as long as your arm, obviously you feel the heat because they have nothing to lose. I often look for first-time winners, and you'll see it happen more often than not. They'll be down the stretch, nine holes to go. It nearly happened actually at Phoenix. Got a Canadian player, and it's completely airballed it. It was a great story, actually. Nick Taylor coming down the stretch Phoenix. In Canada. Exactly. And if there's a buffer on third place, if there's two or three shots, mm-hmm. so you have the headliner leading and you've got the so-called, you know, just the dog nipping at their heels, but there's a buffer on third place, that's when those type of players are really dangerous because they go, I've got nothing to lose now. I can actually afford to hit the shot. And if I make a bogey, so be it. I've still got third place covered. And that's when they just actually go ahead and they play. And then the better player, too, knows they're not going to go away. And you get a lot of those first-time winners beating good players at good golf courses, too, because good golf courses don't really care what your name is. If you can't hit the shot, you're not going to win around here. Hmm. And you know, the Copperhead golf course is like that. More credit, too, to Taylor Moore, because he played, correct me if I'm wrong, because I didn't do the broadcast, but he played the snake pit either even or one under for the week. I don't think he ever made a bogey on the snake pit. So his ability to play the tough holes well is another reason why the victory stands out.
Yep. Yeah, it's a cool story. And you look at his statistics over the years, his putter has made huge gains. They basically rebuilt his entire putting stroke, you know, and then just incrementally better at the full swing. Driving got better. Short game maybe arguably is his weakness, but getting better. And I think shout out to a guy by the name of Brian Sorensen also, who was a guy that worked with Taylor Moore in his game in his hometown growing up and still a voice and part of the team. So there you have it, Taylor Moore. Now you know more about him than you did before you watched this with Frank and I. All right, let's talk about this golf ball. Perhaps you've heard.
Yeah.
Perhaps. Man, there's so many. Look, these guys are well compensated, but it's just human nature to feel a little bad for these guys now where they get into the boardroom and it's first questions about LIV, next questions about the golf ball, third questions about the USGA. I mean, it's like there's 3, 4, 5 things that we want to talk about before. Oh, yeah, how's the game? You know, it's like there's so many things happening off the golf course right now. But the distance debate, I'll just come out and ask you. I've got some questions here. I'll just tee you up on each one of them. The first is, does something need to happen in the way of distance? Do we have a distance problem in the world of professional golf? Now, I don't know what it is yet, but just the idea that we have an issue. Do we in the pro game as far as distance?
Well, I'm going to say something different. We have a distance problem across the board, and I know that's going to offend a lot of amateurs, but, you know, we've been led down the garden track now for a number of years. And so I get all the discussions now, but, you know, we live in this sort of confirmation bias world now. So in other words, if you don't agree with me, you're wrong. Or if I don't agree with you, you're wrong. So we can't discuss it anymore. And I remember doing when I used to do live from and I remember Brandel once saying about the stimp meter. And, you know, we were talking about, I think it was at Oakmont, how fast the greens were. And the greens had got, you know, incredibly quick. And he goes, the stimp meter is one of the worst inventions ever known to golf. And I'd never thought about the direction he'd gone down there in this. And to be honest, I actually agree with it now. And he just said, it's become a competition. How you know, who can have the fastest green? So it costs money, right? Fastest greens. And now really it's who can have the firmest and the fastest green. So we see that at the elite level. And now it's also dragged into the club level. So now your dues, you've got to pay more because our greens are only 9. We've got to get those to 10 or 11. So little bit by little bit, it goes all through the game. But in amongst that, I know from when I used to play, for example, you know, obviously it went from wood to metal. So you went from a golf club that was the equivalent of about 190 cc's, for example, the old driver. Now it's 460. So that's a huge jump in the longest club in the bag, plus the length of it. Everybody went crazy last year when they said we're going to cap it at 46 inches. Nobody even talks about it now. They don't. That was a huge subject a year ago. Mm-hmm. What about tall people? Well, there's club feet, right? It's no big deal. There's been tall people before. It's a big story. But the agronomists have a say in this discussion. Architects have a say in this discussion. Obviously, recreational players have a say in this discussion as well as professional. But in the end, what's the best thing for the sport? You know, at the moment, when every week when I cover golf now, every bunker is in the rough. So I'm pretty sure that's not what the architect wants. And yet some people's opinion, and hey, everybody's entitled to opinion, to somehow rein, you know, the distance that these players, it has grown more rough. Well, we've already shrunk the fairways in because the bunkers are already in the rough. So we're not even really playing like the architects. And you have to cut trees down, for example, when you open it up, because trees do grow. So we do all these little things, but a little bit by little, that ball and driver combination got more and more and more. I saw a stat the other day by Lou Stagno. I should credit him because it's not my stat. I think he said 1980, there wasn't a single player on the tour. Now, I know I'm talking about the elite level player again, that averaged over 275 yards. Right now, there's not a single player that averages under 275 yards. That's the whole tour. Mm-hmm. So you had the whole tour back then, and now the whole tour is above. So it's not like we're cutting off arms and legs here. They're literally putting a line in the sand and saying, look, it's a bit crazy. To use other sports as an example, if you go back to the Beijing Olympics, I think it was, they had those sort of shiny swimming suits. They bust a ton of world records. They didn't hesitate. 2 years later, they banned them. I think it's 2019 was the first person that ever broke 2 hours in the marathon. And they were the Nike Vaporfly shoes, I think they were. You can't use those anymore. They say, I think it's like a 4% increase, right? And the reason why all those decisions were made is what's best for the sport. So I understand how the recreational player is led to believe they're going to lose this massive amount of yardage. I promise you they're not. Or even if a Justin Thomas or a pick the player on the tour, whatever, loses 5 or 10 yards, is that really the end of the world if we're going to make this game more sustainable? And remember, by the time this is done, we're further down the track anyway. If you go back decade by decade and you go, well, hey, you know, look what's happening in Augusta this year, having to push the tee back. And the game's got slower and slower. Well, you have to walk further and further back. When you go from 10 at Augusta to 11, it's 100 yards back to the tee. Now, you used to just walk off the greens and tee. There's a lot of little things, in my opinion, that are part of the argument. So I say, you know, it's time. It really is time. It didn't sneak under us. We knew people were worried about lawsuits. They still are. Yep. And if we don't do anything, if we don't act like grown-ups, then I do fear for the future.
So the pro game, you're saying yes, but the amateur game, leave it alone.
No, I'm saying it. I'm not necessarily a great believer in bifurcation. Okay. We bifurcate by talent, right? But I really think we've become the Formula One sport right now because we're like Mercedes was, you know, 5 or 6 years ago in Formula One. We're just going to make a better and better car. So then what do? They change the rules. We've got to make it more competitive. Tennis, they put more fluff on the ball to make it slower. You know, tennis had its problem. They used to have spaghetti stringing years ago. But they're like, hey, this is wrong. You get an abnormal amount of spin. It's unfair. It gives lesser players that opportunity. I really, as a kid, I used to play the small ball. So, I think I posted this on Twitter the other day because I'm not exactly the Twitter expert out here. But you know, like I'm like, we had bifurcation then. So we grew up, the rest of the world, bar America, grew up with a different size golf ball. It went further and it flew straighter. So, but in order for us to be any better or to play against the best players in the world, which happened to be American then, we had to adopt a bigger ball that didn't go as far and actually was harder to control. You know what ushered in after that? Europe. Mm-hmm. By Steris, Feldo, Langer, Lyle, Wisner. You had the great American dominance was actually now being challenged by Europe. Greg Norman then also was part of that because we adopted the same ball. And I don't think you can give a 12-year-old kid that's going to be a great player one day a different golf ball. Like I said, I think through the whole system, the recreational player is not going to lose much. It's not going to be the same. I think the recreational player still wants to play the same ball. They still want to play the same brand. They don't get the same benefits. You know that. They don't get the same driver fitting, the best players in the world, dude. They're not getting the same benefits. So, I think it's a storm in the teacup. I honestly do.
See, I probably come down more on the other side. It's interesting. I like to hear both sides of the discussion. And I don't like bifurcation either. I think it's got to be one way or the other. I would probably err on the other side. I feel like being in the industry, how far golf has come in the last probably 3 years. I think we all agree the silver lining of COVID was the game of golf and how many people came back to the sport. Someone who's in the sport with a coaching background, I mean, I can see the boom in participation. I think if you bring the ball back, I think most that there'd obviously be some pushback at the pro game. But if you didn't do it at the amateur game, I think, or if you did do it at the amateur game, I think the perception of that wouldn't set well. And I don't think it would. I do think there would be an impact on the amateur game if you brought the golf ball back, because let's face it, most amateurs don't hit it as far as they can anyway. So any distance that they can get with the ball or the driver or anything is a bonus for them. So I really think about the amateur in that. And when I say bifurcation and I bring it back, I feel like now it's finally we're moving in the right direction as a whole in the game of golf. And now I feel like we're taking a step back. That's what it feels like on the outside looking at it. Now we're taking a step back at a time when we should be thriving.
I get that discussion. And I think that's why we should discuss it, the situation like grownups. I don't think there's a perfect answer. Right. But it's something that we should embrace all parts of the argument. I could sort of counter that to a certain degree and say, well, if you fell asleep 10 years ago and then you woke up now, or should I say you woke up in 26, the game would be no different. You'd say it'd still be great. It's where do we go if we keep following the trend? People hit the ball further and further and further. So what do we do? We've mirrored that. We were talking about agronomy before. We faster greens and firmer greens and tighter pin placements, hole locations, whatever verbiage you want, have actually nullified the scoring. So when someone says, well, the course record's still 62, I'm like, have you turned on the TV and looked at some of the old footage? The flags were virtually in the middle of the green, 15 feet, 20 feet from the edge. They're now 3 paces from the edge, from the waterline. Look at the Players' Championship on 17, just from an architectural point of view. On the Sunday, where the flag is on Sunday, which is tucked on the right. If you hit it left of center and you've got to putt over the brow of the hill, if you notice there on the edge of the green, there's a little strip of rough. That should never be there. But it's a backup, because if you putt it from 30 feet and you have people, because maybe the wind blew from left to right, you would have people literally putting it into the water. And I know a couple did anyway. That's bad for golf. So we can't really have them any faster. We can't have them any further. The guys on tour are that good, and they really are. They're better than my generation. Anybody that says they're not is crazy. Because they've learned you should be better than the previous generation.
Yeah.
But we're pushing the limits everywhere. We're pushing them all the way back. We're trying to get more yardage. We're trying to get the greens firmer. And I just think we've got to sort of say, is that really the way we want to go? And look what happened on Saturday after a little bit of rain. They shot the grass off the ball, off the course. I mean, it's the lowest ever scoring average there. The 62, the course record was broke, all because the greens were a fraction softer. So in some respects, if you give these guys a longer club, it doesn't matter if the target's receptive. And I think the average amateur would benefit from that as well, is because of this chase for faster, firmer greens. The average amateur gets punished. I never grew up on greens that were 12, 13 on the stim. I didn't learn the game that way.
God, no.
Yeah, so that's what I think's hard for the average amateur. Yeah. That when they chip on these really fast greens, it's frightening for them.
Yeah.
And it's unfair.
And that's a very small percent of courses that are, that have the speed. Like I teach at Pablo Creek here. Yep. I teach at Pablo Creek some here in Jacksonville, and that's a very nice private course. And those greens are so fast and they're just beautiful, right? And then you go to some of the other public facilities there and they're not that fast, right? I mean, they're running 9.5, somewhere in there. So,
which is great.
Yeah, right. Yep, I mean, we're talking about a very, very small percent of golf courses. Let me throw this at you. I want to get this reaction from you. I follow the PGA Tour very closely, probably not as closely as you do, certainly not in the norm as much as you are out there in hearing these discussion with so many experts. But it just feels like the PGA Tour does a really good job mixing up these different courses. They come over to Florida. These courses are difficult, but they mix it up, you know, pretty well. Some are a little more open than others. Some are a little bit tighter than others. Some got longer rough than others. Maybe the driver plays in a little more distance, plays a little more of a factor on this course for where it doesn't at a course like Harbortown, you know, those kinds of things. But I can't think of that many courses on the PGA Tour that, I mean, okay, Augusta, they've had to move back a tee. They've got the money to do that. But I can't think of that many courses in the United States from a professional level that are really up against it. I know there's some, but are really up against it and like, oh my gosh, we can't take on five more yards. But in Europe, it feels like St. Andrews and some others, right, that don't have rough, that have to be careful with green speeds because of the wind, that if you play those courses and there's no weather, it's over, right? So it just feels like it's a bigger issue perhaps internationally, Europe, than it is maybe some of the courses in the United States from a professional standpoint. Is that accurate or no?
I think that's a very good observation. And I'd like to sort of point out one thing that you've made. It is a global game. So
the
responsibility of the USGA and the RNA is obviously for the benefit of everybody around the world. And I think sometimes when we look at architecture, we look at people love the look of an American golf course. It's green, and they see the old course at St. Andrews, and they go, brown, it's not very good, until they play it. But you know, the last few times I've been at St. Andrews, you know, they've got a couple of tees that are out of bounds. Mm. They're literally, you're teeing off from out of bounds. You know, like they've stuck a tee over the fence. And you could only do it at the elite level because the recreational player, if they littered one, they'd still be out of bounds. So, you know, it's farcical, some of the things that have had to be done. So I just see a trend, that's all.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I want everybody to be able to enjoy. When I got to walk over the Swilkin Bridge for the first time, for example, I realized that everybody, the Sam Sneeds, the Ben Hogan didn't play there, but, you know, Bobby Jones, every player really of note had walked over the same bridge and got to play that same golf course. Yeah. And then for it to be taken off the rotor, which is extremely close, and I think that's, you know, obviously it's also the home of the RNA, and be replaced by another golf course, it would be a sad day in golf. And I know that's only one golf course, but there are places all the way around the world. And I don't know where the next best player is going to come from. They might, you know, Vijay Singh came from Fiji and got to number one in the world. I mean, their golf courses, I mean, they only have a handful then. So, you know, we have an obligation to look after everybody. And that's also why I don't agree with bifurcation, is because it's a great game, whether it's played by someone for the very, very first time or the best player in the world. And I just think in the end, that's what I mean, cooler heads. Is it that big a deal if we can just make this game last a little longer? So, I've been wrong, you know, more often than not. So.
No, I think it's interesting. I mean, I like hearing the discussion because I think you bring up a lot of good points, and I'm just looking at some of the responses and whatnot, and you're certainly having an impact on some people that were 100% my way, you know, and now they're listening to you talk. Man, I really never thought of it that way, and I think that's what has to continue to evolve here, rather than stop talking. You know, like this is how I feel. You know, I think the discussion has to go. I do think though. What'll the heavy hand in this will be the PGA Tour player, right? And whether the PGA Tour adopts this, because it is a local rule. USGA is not saying, all right, everybody flip the switch. This is the way it is. So it just feels like the majority, heavy majority so far from what I've read and what I've listened to from the PGA Tour players is they're just, boy, it's a non-starter. They're like, no, we're good. Like this is... we're fine with the way the golf ball is. So if the PGA Tour in a couple of years doesn't sign up for this, then what do we have? Like now we have an issue, I think, at that point.
Yeah, there's a lot of things we could talk about. It's a bit like not all the PGA Tour players signed up for no cuts. And I know when we go, you know, Austin this week, it'll be the, you know, c'est la vie, you know, see you later for the World Golf Championship events. And then we're going to have a, you know, another iteration of them next year, which... hey, if it goes according to, I don't think the PGA Tour, whether it's the Australasian Tour where I grew up from, the European Tour, the South African Tour, Japanese Tour, LIV Tour, doesn't matter. I don't think they should be making the rules for everybody. They're the best version of the game. And that's what every young player, you know, I know when I was a kid growing up, I remember watching the 1975 Masters. And it was, you know, Jack Nicklaus and Johnny Miller and Tom Weisskopf. And they were there. I was so impressionable. I was thousands of miles away in New Zealand, but I got to see a place and I'm like, wow, wouldn't it be great if one day I got to play there? And so you want kids all over the world to be able to see that and aspire to that. But I don't think necessarily that the best in the game should be responsible for making the rules for the majority of the game. And it's, I go back to the 46-inch driver. All the furore really was generated by the players last year. And then the average amateur got up in arms because he or she was made to believe they were going to stop you and they were stealing yardage from you. And yet I didn't know a single player that had a driver that was 46 or 47 inches long. But that was what they were sold. And they nearly created a movement that might have very well stopped that move. But nobody talks about the rule anymore because really it's of no benefit to anyone. So it's like, hey, we're fine. We don't have to do that. And I just, it's only my opinion, but I think it's a great game for every level of play.
Yeah.
I really do.
So guy listening right now, Kevin says, well said, Frank. It's a global game, not an American one. Golf doesn't revolve around the PGA Tour. I think it's a... candid statement. Like, you have to look at it globally, internationally, and I think you have to look at it from not just the pro game but the amateur game as well. And that's where I get hung up. Anyway, I could continue down that path forever. I gotta ask you this though, Kev or yeah. Frank, before I let you go, what was it like going from a persimmon driver to a metal driver for the first time? Were you like, give me that thing back, this is fun? What was that like?
I actually had this discussion with Jordan Spieth at an AT&T dinner because, I mean, Jordan's great in that environment. He gets asked the tough questions with, you know, with a bit about live or whatever, and he gives a tremendous answer. So then I've known him for a decade now, and I'm a big fan of his golf. I like the fact that it's all out there, right? So if you ask him a question, so he was sort of ribbing me a bit, and I'm like, yeah, that's right. I grew up with a hickory shaft. He goes, no, I didn't mean it that way, but... So it's sort of the same question. And I remember going from, I had a Harry Busson driver, which was made at Walton Heath. And it used, I thought it was big. I really did. You know, it was a big driver, right? But, you know, not when you see it now. And I remember going to, I think one of the first metal-headed drivers was the TaylorMade Burnett, but I had a precision shaft in it. It had like 7.5. And I'm like, well, this is the coolest thing I've ever seen. And finally, I can drive the ball sort of the height I wanted. And then seeing the evolution of that. But, you know, we were still using 56 degree wedges. And in those days too, we used to have an international dinner at Augusta. And I think it was 1996 when we had the international dinner, and the members then, so this is 27 years ago, were worried about equipment and where it was going. And the discussion that night was literally about the 56 degree wedge, because we thought 60 degree, it took away skills of biased errors. And in those days too, the driver, we were using metal headed drivers like 7 degrees of loft, because we thought it was pre-track, man. So we didn't know. We were told to hit down and make it go up. All these things that you have straightened people out with. And TrackMan Maestro, I remember spending weekend after weekend arguing with him over the phone about, well, you know, TrackMan, how can that be right? We were told this and that. To this day, it's an education for me, and I'm very thankful. But we were like, oh, we've got to go less and less loft. But then eventually, as it opens up for the recreational player, as it does the elite player, you're like, wow, this is a new game. It really is a new game. It was more fun, and it was. There was more things you could adjust, like the adjustable drivers now. I think are great. You know, some of the technology, the way it's gone down to the average golfer, I don't think they should be $700. I think it's too much to expect an average player to do that, but... The little things involved in the club now, I think are great because they're open-minded and they really do help. You know, you buy one driver, you can still adjust it. So there's so many good things that have happened. I would never want to go back to a persimmon driver. I think there's so many good things. There are good things that have happened to the game. The utility club, great, you know, great club for the game. Yeah. And you know, 60-degree wedge, probably a better club for the elite player than the average player. Yeah. I think the average player struggles with them all loft. But utility clubs, some of the putter things, that, you know, designs and that around the shaft technology. There's so many good things in the game now. But, yeah, the transition was different. The sound was the biggest transition.
Wow. I can remember when I first got into the sport, you know, with the persimmon. It was 1980, 79, 80, I think, when they made the switch, right, from into metal. I think somewhere in there.
Yeah, it was close. Well, actually, you can steal one of the nuggets that I've got for this year because it's 1983. Everybody else can use it anyway. Who's the last player to win a major with a wooden driver?
It's 83?
It was 83. And at Augusta, Bernard Langer, yeah.
Wow. Man, he's been doing a lot of winning. He's been doing a lot of winning since.
But that's, you know, it's like it just happens to be 30 years ago. Payne Stewart was the last player to win the PGA Championship with a wooden driver. And hey, things change. They evolve. But if it's for the right reasons, then good. Yeah.
I'm trying to think. The McGregor. I had the McGregors.
Yeah, they were good. There was the Cleveland, I think it was TC75.
Yeah.
They were hot. But Harry Busson was a clubsmith. They had a Ryder Cup at Walton Heath. And I remember a lot of the Americans would go in and they would get Harry Busson to make, you know, talk to any of the older players that played in that Ryder Cup at Walton Heath. And they all got handmade drivers to take back to America. And Wood Brothers in Texas were excellent. Wood Brothers, I think. Yeah.
This LIV thing going to make it, Frank? This LIV golf thing, you think? What do you think?
I think it's going to change. You know, hey, there's a lot of things if you're commissioner for a day. I just said it's a global game. I really wish, and I have friends that have gone. I get it. I don't agree with going back and suing the tour. If you're going to leave, you leave. And I know I'm not the first person to say that. But I really thought the best thing for the LIV model to do was to go globally. Go to Australasia. Like the tournament they're going to have in Adelaide will be huge. Golf starved in that area. Go to Africa, go to places in Asia, and really do copy the Formula One model. And then eventually, if it succeeded, and it would be good for golf, because you really would be spreading the game around. And then eventually, maybe there was a chance to for the two to be, you know, I don't know, playing some sort of Ryder Cup or tour against tour. But they put a line in the sand when they said, we want to play in America. So I don't blame the tour for standing, you know, digging their heels in the ground and now, you know, like if somebody invades your territory, so to speak, and they start to sue you, then really, what are you going to do? That's pretty much what happens in a bar. If you stay in a bar too late and somebody says something at you and you say something back, I mean, nothing good's going to happen. So I've seen that happen before. Yeah. So that's pretty much where we are, sadly. I know that's not a great answer to your question. They have a bottomless pit of money. So as long as they're engaged, then it would happen. If they lose interest, they have in other sports sometimes. But I also fear other sports because I don't know if this is a test run.
Yeah.
The game of golf. That could be scary as well. So
yeah. Well, it's, you know, it's a whole other box of worms. I went into watching LIV with an open mind and like, all right, you know, I enjoy watching these guys play golf. And I give it a fair shake, you know, through the whole last year. I gave them a lot of credit for what they were able to accomplish and put together. I watch the product now, and it's just not for me. I have a hard time taking it serious. Like, when I watch the telecast, it doesn't appear to be that serious for the players involved. And as someone who's watching it, it doesn't, like, I don't take it that serious either. You know, I told Peter Costas on the podcast a couple weeks ago, it's like watching a carnival with a golf tournament weaved within it. It's just hard for me to really wrap my mind around that this really means something to these people. And I know they say the team competition, and I respect the idea of trying to push that forward. I think it is their lane that they have to try to push forward, and all the guys are saying they're on board and whatnot. But it just comes across a little silly to me. And in the end, I just wish a lot of those guys were still back part of the PGA Tour. You know, that's just the way I feel about it. But I do think, as far as the endless pit of money, I do think that there's probably some pressure that's going to be start putting down. And just even from some of the reporting from Alan Shipnuck out there in Fire Pit, spending some time there, I think they're starting to get a sense from the guys above that we need to start seeing some movement here in the way of sponsorship and perhaps more money coming in that currently is not at this point. So I do think some of the expenses, the players and the teams are going to have to start picking up now versus where everything was caviar and shrimp cocktails and parties and this and that. Some of that's going to start drying up here. And then what does that mean for those players that have signed up? So it's going to be interesting here in year two. They've got, you know, look, they've done a lot of good things. But there's a lot to prove there, I think, in the world of a real business model for this year and years to come.
You're right. And that's why I think they should be on a different time zone. I think if they were playing around the world, the viewer, because the viewer also gets starved in some respects. I know you can flip backwards and forwards, but normally you're committed to one or the other.
Yeah.
But if you're playing, you know, 4 or 5 hours later, so to speak, different time zone or first thing in the morning, then there's the opportunity to watch both products fairly. And you're not, the goal isn't to compete. In other words, it's to do a product. I mean, you'll see that in a lot of other sports. You know, soccer is huge outside America. I know it's growing big in this country. But, you know, if for example, in London, my daughter lives there, you know, I can watch, you know, NFL in the evening. I can watch soccer during the day. So I get to watch two big sports when you're over there, different time zones. And it is a shame that we're getting a clash because, you know, fights can be unavoidable. But if you're going to say we're going to play here and we're going to play at the same time, well, then like I said, yeah. You know what's going to happen. And I don't, it becomes a turf war.
Well, and I think and Liv has claimed, look, we're kind of reinventing golf, and for a younger generation, and you know, our leaderboard is going to be as good. Look at all these top players that we were able to pay and come over. You know, all these things. So, you know, they've flexed, right? Like they're in this to compete, and I think their ratings will be a little better on Sunday just because they went into the playoff and. Mm. You know, the PGA Tour was over, and I think naturally you're just like, oh, more golf, you know, more golf's on, so I'm going to go over there. But I just think in the end that team competition is where they've got to hang their hat, and I think you've got to continue to look at some of the non-elevated events, but try to find some time frames that are not going to go directly head to head. To your point,
you're right. But just to finish, I mean,
yeah.
The Nick Taylor we talked about, that story at Phoenix, Chris Kirk, Eric Cole at Honda, you know, last week, you know, Taylor Moore, those stories they're organic. You know, they happen because, you know, kids, they look at the game when they're young and they aspire to be better and better and better. And at the moment, the various tours around the world allow that avenue. And we don't know when they're going to strike next and we get another first-time winner and they become a champion. And that's, you know, you asked me about Jordan Spieth. I remember 10, 11 years ago, his rookie season. And Fred Couples picked him for the President's Cup team. I don't ever want to see those stories disappear. And every, we're lucky. We have an embarrassment of talent. So I like the pipeline. You know, I always look at it like a funnel, right? We have a big funnel and we spit out champions. I don't ever want that to be broken.
Yeah, Pearson Cootie, here he comes. Right? That's the next one now. It's going to start climbing. All right, Frank, I've taken enough of your time. Go back to your vacation. I look forward to watching you on CBS. Always, I really love your work. Thanks so much.
Cheers, Travis. Take care, Mike.